Okay, thanks. Unfortunately, my old computer refuses to talk to that projection system. So thanks, Gary, for letting me use yours. Yeah, that was my charge to talk about astrophysical cosmological neutrino limits. And so I'll mostly view this as talk about ordinary stars, supernova, and maybe a little bit of cosmology. Other topics like high-energy cosmic rays may be covered by other speakers. So what is it we actually want to know about neutrinos? I mean, I think there's three broad subjects. One is the question of what are the standard properties of the active neutrinos? There's the mass, mixing parameters, which of course cosmology is the main source of information about the neutrino masses. Mixing parameters play a role in supernova physics. And of course, the Dirac-Majorana question is important in leptogenesis that Pasquale will talk about later. They will ask about non-standard properties of active neutrinos, which might be electromagnetic interactions, non-standard interactions, and such things, which can play a role in various environments. And finally, we can ask, is there even other than the ordinary neutrinos, stellar neutrinos, and such things, which have various implications that have been discussed at this conference already. So I want to pick a few subjects in this broad area to cover here that may not have been covered yet in this conference. Let me begin with one topic that is not talked about very much these days. So I want to update you on that, which is the neutrino electromagnetic properties. So here, one should note that any fermion, any neutral fermion in particular, can have electromagnetic form factors. And in general, you know, going through all these different Dirac structures, one kind of a charge form factor, an unipole moment, and then, of course, magnetic and electric dipole moments. And these are, of course, especially interesting because they couple states of opposite helicity and can lead to the excitation of wrong helicity states. Or in the case of Majorana neutrinos, the other state by a transition magnetic moment. So these neutrino dipole, magnetic dipole moments are not very exotic. They are necessary to appear in the standard model once neutrinos have masses. So neutrinos, a neutrino mass can flip left to right, and therefore this loop will contribute to an electromagnetic interaction, which is proportional to the neutrino masses. So neutrino magnetic and electric dipole moments are just another manifestation of neutrino masses and should appear both in the Dirac and Majorana case, either as diagonal moments or as transition moments, and they are calculable and are proportional to the mass and some mixing parameters. And that's, of course, exactly the graph that contributes to that line, which has been talked about in the case of sterile neutrino, the case, the 3.5 kV line. Numerically, though, these numbers come out very small. So in the case of a Dirac case, a diagonal electric magnetic dipole moment would come out in this unit in 10 to minus 19 Bohr magnetons if the mass is around electron volt, which is a very, very small number. And if we talk about off-diagonal elements which cause radiative decay or Majorana transitions, then we're talking about an even smaller number that has to do with an effect called the Jim cancellation, where in the loop the various flavored charged leptons cancel to lowest order. So if neutrinos have masses in the sub-electron volt range, as we now believe, we're talking about these 10 to minus 20 type Bohr magneton numbers. So what that means is this is a very, very small number. I like to show it on a plot like this, which is the famous Hillers plot. We usually show in the context of cosmic ray acceleration, but one shows the geometric size and field strength of different astrophysical objects. And so they sort of lie on this diagonal. So if the dipole moment were in this 10 to minus 12 range, then it would be quite reasonable. If it's in this 10 to minus 20 range, then there's just no astrophysical object where it could flip left to right over a distance scale that is accessible. So, I mean, looking for dipole moments is really a bad way to search for neutrino masses. It's kind of not accessible. So if one wants to look for effects caused by neutrino dipole moments, then it has to originate from some non-standard physics. So evidence for such things, of course, would immediately point towards non-standard physics. So it's worth finding out what we know about these dipole moments from astrophysics. So one aspect is that has been discussed years ago, but not very recently, is this effect of spin flavor oscillations in media. So neutrinos, of course, suffer flavor oscillations in the ordinary way, modified by matter. But in addition, one can have spin flavor oscillations. So a transition dipole moment can flip an electron neutrino to a muon antineutrino. And so if one has sufficient configurations of B fields and meta gradients, one can have these resonance spin flavor conversions, which, and that is the interesting part, in principle could produce an anti-neutrino flux where you at the source expect only neutrino flux. So in principle, it's worthwhile to worry about, for example, an anti-neutrino flux from the sun, which of course has not been observed. So there are these limits from Borg-Zeno and the Kamlan experiment, which tell us that the Nui-Nui bar transition probability is less than a few times to the minus 5 or so. So these numbers are, of course, heroic as far as experiments are concerned, but don't tell us very much about dipole moments, because even if one assumes a rather large B field in the sun, this will not give a very strong transition rate. Okay, so then what do we know about these dipole moments from astrophysics and cosmology? So the main argument is a very old one, which I want to recap for you here, which has to do with neutrinos being emitted from stars by various processes. So neutrinos can be emitted from stars by these various, you know, quantum Bremsstrahlung and so on. And one very important process point out in the 1960s is this plasmon decay process, which is important in various astrophysical environments, where a photon decays into neutrino pair in the medium. Now, of course, this process is completely forbidden in vacuum, but in the medium, photons acquire a refractive mass by the plasma mass, basically, and they acquire also an effective coupling just mediated by the electrons of the medium, so neutrinos couple to photons, and one can get this plasma decay. And that is the dominant process in a range of densities and temperatures that is quite relevant for stars. The basic reason being that the medium in stars tends to be more or less degenerate. I mean, the sun and other stars are always on the verge of electron degeneracy. So compared to the temperature, the density is fairly high typically. So this plasmon decay process is an important process for the cooling of all sorts of stars. Now that can be used to constrain electromagnetic form factors of neutrinos is an old story. It goes back to the paper by Bernstein, Rudermann, and Feinberg almost exactly 50 years ago, where they pointed out that if one has these electromagnetic interactions of neutrinos directly coupling them to the photons, then you get this excess energy loss of stars that can be used to constrain these electromagnetic properties. And it's kind of pathetic to see, I mean, how little one knew about neutrinos in those days. So in those days, that was a fairly revolutionary idea. So where has that taken us today? I mean, the argument, the most restrictive argument on this kind of stuff is also a fairly old idea, but has been revisited recently, so let me update you on it. So the main idea is to look at the energy loss of ordinary stars, and that can be tested by looking at things called globular clusters, which are these sort of agglomerations of stars in the Milky Way, which are very, they tend to have the same age and the same chemical composition. So they lend themselves as a test bed for stellar evolution theory. So if one plots these stars in this way, where the color or surface temperature is on one axis and the brightness on the other axis, then that picture makes a lot more sense. It's much more physical. So one sees all the main sequence stars, which are the ordinary hydroburning stars, and then the red giants up here, which are stars which burn hydrogen in a shell and have a degenerate helium core. That degenerate helium core wants to ignite, and so the brightest red giant up here is the one which just wants to ignite helium, and you can delay that by cooling it too much. The question is, how bright is the brightest red giant in globular clusters? If it's kind of too bright than you think, then there should be extra cooling by neutrino dipole moments. So we've recently revisited this argument. This is mostly Nicolas Fiost's doctoral thesis. He was a student in Santiago de Chile. So here is another globular cluster, M5 is its name. So here you see the color magnitude diagram, and up here is the brightest star, which blowing up the red giant branch you see right here. So the function of color and infrared brightness. The question is, how bright is that guy, and how bright should it be with or without extra cooling? So the main point of this exercise was to go through a whole list of possible astrophysical uncertainties and theoretical uncertainties. You know, what goes in from stellar evolution theory that might make these arguments uncertain. So what we came up with is a plot like this, where we show, first of all, the observational brightness of that brightest star in these magnitude units. So the main uncertainty of that, of the absolute brightness of the star, comes from the Poulenon distance. I mean, it's the usual thing. The distance of astrophysical objects is the usual difficult thing in astronomy. And so that's where the main uncertainty comes from. And that green band here shows, as a function of the supernatural magnetic dipole moment, how bright should be that brightest star in the globular cluster. So you see, if there were no extra cooling, in fact, I mean, there's a, I mean, not a real, but of a minor discrepancy. So in some sense, one wants a little bit of extra cooling, but it's not significant, which is a terrible outcome here, because it means our bound is bad. I mean, it's the worst thing if you get sort of a weak indication, because then you get a bad bound. So then roughly one comes up with a bound on the dipole moment of some 3 to 4 Bohr magnetons from this argument. So the interesting point about, so the main uncertainty, by the way, in the theoretical issue here is actually the bolometric correction, which tells us how to translate the absolute energy emission of the star into the infrared magnitudes that are observed by astronomers. So in future, this probably can be made more precise once we know the distances better in the galaxy. So I draw your attention to that thing called the Gaia mission, which is a satellite out there, which is still the Planck satellite of astrometry. It will measure about, I think, 1 billion stars in the galaxy, exact distances. And it will give us a much better 3D image of the galaxy. It will allow one to pin down these distances much better. So this error bar may shrink, and then one could actually see if there might be a small discrepancy or not, or if it all boils down and the limits will improve. Okay, there are other arguments that help one to use the same effect as a plasmon decay, but using other observables. So one class of stars where we can test this idea are white dwarfs. So white dwarfs are these compact remnants at the end of the evolution of low mass stars. And one can observe a thing called the white dwarf luminosity function, which tells as a function of brightness how many of these things are around us in the galaxy. So there are few bright and young ones, and many dim and old ones. So these are the old ones. And you can see there is this sort of conspicuous dip here in the distribution, which means these things cool fast. That is actually an indication of this plasmon decay. This plasmon. So I mean, I was always worried about this neutrino process, plasmon decay, which you can never measure in the lab, right? Is actually real, or is it just some fantasy? But it seems to be real. So okay. So if one switched on dipole moment, this would depress even more here. And Marcello Miller-Bertolami has gone through this recently, and found again another limit of about 4 or 5 Bohr magnetons just from this white dwarf luminosity function argument. So finally, there's an intriguing argument, again involving white dwarfs. There's one class of white dwarfs which are actually unstable. They are pulsating. And this pulsation period depends on the cooling speed. And so there have been these heroic efforts of measuring not only the periods of these white dwarfs, but actually the period change, which for that particular guy, which is called PG3051 plus 489, I'll quiz you on that number later, its period changes with 2 × 10⁻³⁷ seconds per second, a very slow decline, and that reveals its cooling speed. So again, the cooling speed of that star within reasonable error bars agrees with standard expectations. So again, one gets again a similar limit of a few, you know, 10⁻¹⁴ Bohr magnetons on the cooling on the magnetic dipole moment from the cooling speed of that variable white dwarf. So all of these things taken together essentially mean that the cooling speed of these stars is roughly in agreement with the standard assumption. So this plasmon, the plasmon decay by standard interactions, the dipole moment are roughly equal, at most roughly equal or smaller. It's not really foreseeable how these arguments could improve very much in future. There's just too much systematic noise in these arguments. So the summary of these dipole limits is the following. If you plot the limit on the magnetic dipole moment of neutrinos at the function of neutrino mass, then if the mass were sort of, you know, electron volts or higher, then radiative decays would be very important. And of course, we heard from this 7 kV sterile neutrino guy, the radiative decay could be very important to even detect it. But if the mass is very small, then this radiative decay phase space suppressed, there's this, you know, cubed factor of neutrino mass coming in. And so for these very small mass neutrinos that we now think of as neutrinos, this plasmon decay argument is the most restrictive one, more so than laboratory limits and more so than other limits. And it's been that way for a long time, and I don't think this will come down very much in future. So that's more or less where we are stuck with this, with these quantities. Say again? No, these apply to all of them, because you see, the final state, you don't know what they are. It applies to everything which is a dipole interact, which is sterile, active, all of them. It's some effective dipole moment in that sense. Yeah, but of course, for these, it would even apply to these KV things which people talk about now. But the dipole moment that you need to get the 3.5 KV gamma line is so extremely small, it wouldn't figure on this plot at all. But if, in principle, you count them all. Yeah. Okay, so much for the dipole moments. Let me now make a few remarks on supernova neutrinos. We had a whole session of supernova neutrinos yesterday, but I think I would like to emphasize a few things which may have not been mentioned, which I think are important. Now, we heard the whole story about massive stars collapsing, having a shock wave which explodes the star, getting neutrinos out that can be measured in big detectors, and that's a great thing to do in future. Now, one interesting point that I want to stress once more is the following. As Chris Fryer explained, one has this situation where the shock wave hovers at some distance and wants to explode, and one needs neutrinos to deposit energy behind the shock wave. And of course, the energy position behind the shock wave is mostly done by inverse beta decay, so the flavor composition of the neutrinos fluxes play an important role. It's almost kind of a joke that flavor oscillation effects don't seem to play any role in this context, because up to the shock wave, the meta density is so high that typically flavor conversion effects are completely suppressed. And that remains true even if we include these self-induced collective flavor oscillation effects, with the caveats mentioned by Ray Sawyer yesterday. So it sounds like flavor oscillation effects, unless we invoke sterile neutrinos, have nothing to do with the supernova explosion directly. It's a bit of a bad sign. So again, in the same vein, I always thought it was almost like a bad joke that after core collapse of a supernova, we have this enormous amount of trapped electron lepton number, which shows up as the degenerate Fermi series of electrons and electron neutrinos in the supernova core, and we have we think neutrinos are Majorana, so they should violate lepton number. They violate maximally the flavor lepton numbers. Yet nothing. The meta effect is so strong, you don't get mu and tau neutrinos excited or antineutrinos. So I always thought it would be interesting to check what would actually happen to a supernova if this were not true, if flavor conversion would after all occur by some non-standard interactions, or if neutrino-antineutrino conversion would occur by some R-parity-valuing Suzy effect or whatever. I mean, people talk about these other causes of lepton number violation other than Majorana masses in the double beta context. So nobody's really studied that. It would be very interesting to know what actually happens to a supernova if it were to deleptonize internally without all this stuff diffusing out. So would we just get a thermal bounce, or what exactly would happen? I think that's a task for numerical simulators to get into. But standard interactions don't really do anything in that direction. One idea that has been pursued by some people recently is the question of sterile neutrinos in the vague KV range that might actually help with supernova explosion, in the sense that you make the sterile neutrinos in the core of the supernova, and they might back convert below the neutrino sphere and deposit energy in that way. So there's an old idea by George Fuller and friends, which has been revived recently by these authors in a very recent paper, and they sort of tested in some schematic investigation how much would be the extra energy deposition behind the shock wave as a function of sterile neutrino mass and mixing angle, and they came up with that region here where one would get a rather significant amount of energy deposition. That region is sort of in this highish mixing angle range, so it's kind of complementary to what one thinks for the dark matter of sterile neutrinos. So in some sense, this supernova, the possible impact of KV neutrinos on supernova would be complementary to the dark matter story. So that's the lesson of this. But it could play some role if these things were to exist. But if there's nothing new about neutrinos and we just have the ordinary masses and mixings, then we would see something like this as far as neutrinos from the supernova. And I like to emphasize we should think in terms of detectors of neutrinos, not just of the supernova as a whole thing. I think we have a lot of time-dependent information. We think of the thing as three phases of something. So there's the infall phase, where we get this big burst of electron neutrinos, this prompt burst. Then this accretion phase, where we get the largest luminosity, because one has the accretion of matter, then the cooling phase of the proto-neutron star after the explosion has gone off. And these three different phases offer different opportunities for neutrino physics. Let me just mention one thing about the first phase, which is much more reliable and reproducible in numerical models than these other phases, which show a lot of variability. So during that first phase, at least in this suite of models provided by the Gaussian group, the first 100 milliseconds, the temperatures, the average energies of the neutrinos of different flavors are very reproducible, independent of the mass of progenitor, but the absolute luminosity is very different. But if one were to plot something like the ice cube signal expected from such a supernova, the rise time, depending on if you're seeing new bars or new X bars, would be very different in a possibly observable way. So which one you actually see depends on the oscillation, the mass hierarchy. So in principle, there's sensitivity to the mass hierarchy. Now, that depends on the prediction of the fluxes, which may not be as reliable as one hopes them to be, but clearly the mass hierarchy has a strong impact on how to interpret that signal. So, I mean, probably one should take it in such a way that it'd be very nice to have the mass hierarchy from the experiments to later interpret the supernova signal that way. But it has sensitivity. It is changed by the mass hierarchy. Unless, of course, it's completely complicated by collective oscillations, which probably is not the case in that early phase. Okay. Another point which I really like is the question of the fast time variations. We heard about the SASI mode in the supernova. There's this sloshing mode of the shockwave against the supernova core, which would imprint itself in a very dramatic way in the neutrino signal, observable in this case in the ice cube, the ice cube paper. And I think it's maybe worth noting that the sort of, in that case, 80 hertz variation of the signal would not be washed out by neutrino mass time of light effects if the neutrino masses are in the sub-electrovolt range that we now believe they are. So I think it's very important for that game to know that neutrinos are very light. So it's sort of turning around. In the olden days, we thought one get these time of flight limits from supernova neutrinos. I think today it's the other way around. We're happy the mass are small. So these effects are not washed out by time of flight effects. So I find this rather intriguing. Now, in the context of studying these effects, we came across something interesting that hasn't been mentioned here yet. So what we're wondering is how much does that kind of stuff depend on the angle on which you look at the supernova? Because this sloshing mode has some preferred direction. So if you look from that direction, you won't see that. If you look on the other direction, you see a big effect. So what we discovered when looking at this is the following completely new effect, which hasn't been mentioned here and hasn't quite sunk in yet with the community, is that what we call the laser effect, the lepton emission self-sustained symmetry effect. What you're seeing here is the lepton number flux from the supernova plotted on a sky map, depending on which direction you look at the supernova. So what happens is that after the first 100 milliseconds or so, a huge dipole symmetry builds up. So when you look at where does the lepton number come out, it comes out all out in sort of one direction. So in this Pacific Ocean region here, no lepton number comes out. So that's a very puzzling, completely new effect, which nobody had seen before. And we only came across it because we were concerned with these direction-dependent ice cube signals in supernova.
Does that give too big a kick?
No. The point is that even though the lepton number comes out very asymmetric, the overall luminosity seems to be very, very 4 pi symmetric to within a few percent. So the kicks are relatively small. Yet the lepton number comes out just in one direction. In this model, at least. So if you look at these two extreme directions of emission, one would see, for example, a large Dewey flux, and the Dewey bar and the other flux would be almost identical, so no flavor oscillation effects in that direction. In the opposite direction, it's completely different. Right? So what you see may depend very much on from which direction you look at the supernova. So this buildup of this dipole is here plotted as a function of post-bounce time, And so the, you know, the what's called the monopole is just the overall lepton number flux, which is fed by the accretion flow, as explained by Chris yesterday. And one sees the dipole growing up to the level of the monopole, so it's kind of a maximal dipole. All the lepton number comes out one direction and not the other direction. And for these three mass stars available from the Gaussian 3D simulations, these show Sarcy, this one doesn't, but you always get the same effect, Sarcy or not. Right, so it's a very intriguing effect that hasn't fully been appreciated yet by anybody. So we think we have a schematic theory of this effect, which has to do with the shock wave being somewhat distorted, that leading to a deflection of the accretion flow, that leading to an asymmetry of the lepton number flow again, that leading to an asymmetry of the heating behind the shock wave, that again feeds back into deformation. So there seems to be a positive feedback cycle that self-maintains this asymmetry, although that's not the complete picture, because it also has to do with the convection inside the neutron star. So in this phase, the neutrino sphere is here. There's convection in the neutron star. And as a function of radius here, the neutrino sphere, this asymmetry builds up already below the neutrino sphere. So how that exactly interacts remains a puzzle at the moment. But in this region below the neutrino sphere, you know, there's a very asymmetric flow of lepton number during that accretion phase. And I just invite people to think about what that might mean, or other groups should confirm this effect. So I think this is a very intriguing, completely new phenomena that people should be aware of. Okay, let me just close the supernova section of my talk with this remark. So we have these three phases of emission of the supernova, and I like to say these three phases offer three opportunities. Each phase has something else to offer to other people. The first phase, which is fairly reproducible, maybe offers some opportunity for studying flavor oscillation effects in the way we have heard yesterday in part. This accretion phase is the phase we get the largest astrophysical variation. The different progenitor stars, different progenitor masses, you look at it from different directions. So there's a lot of astrophysical stuff one can test here. I think it would be great to see an ice cube, these fast time variations, to test the hydrodynamical issues that happens in the supernova. So, of course, flavor conversion would have a strong impact on that phase, but it's so complicated, it's very difficult to disentangle this. So if we knew there was a sterile neutrino from, you know, from the upcoming very short baseline experiments, or if we knew the mass hierarchy from other experiments, it would be much easier to interpret the signal during that phase later on. And finally, there's that cooling phase, where probably things like the nuclear equation of state play a role. Long-term cooling effects by axions, such things may play a role. So that offers yet a different kind of opportunity. So one should really look at this supernova signal as three different experiments in one, learning different things from different phases. That's my opinion. So like I'm closing the supernova part of my talk, and just because nobody else has done this in this conference, say a few words about the last topic, about what cosmology can do for neutrinos, which is weighing neutrinos with the universe. That's of course the royal discipline of neutrino physics in astrocosmology, because that's where we can get some real information about neutrinos. Okay, let me just add a few words to what Gary has already said. I mean, the main point of this whole game is the following: that neutrinos would be free streaming if they're small, are free streaming with small masses, that would wash out structure in the universe. And so, as is well known, they would suppress small scale structure in the universe because they would suppress the primordial power spectrum of density fluctuations. So on that plot, what's shown here is the transfer function, that is the sort of the deviation of the structure as it's modified by neutrinos, where the zero line corresponds to the standard lambda CDM picture. And so if we are after, as we are, to find a 50 or 60 millielectron volt neutrino mass in the universe, then the suppression here is a few percent, 4 or 5%. So that's the charge. One wants to test at small scales a suppression of the structure by 5%. And that's within reachable, within reach in future. So different probes, the CMB galaxy surveys, re-cleansing, the Lyman alpha, test different parts of that spectrum, and in their combination give us the results that we have been talking about. One important point to note in this context is just a sort of an important small point, which is that this suppression of the power spectrum here in the linear regime is given by the fraction of the neutrino density over the overall matter density multiplied by a factor of 8. right? So there's a strong boost effect here, which follows from linear from structure formation in the linearized regime. And so it is that enhancement factor that makes that whole stuff possible in the first place. So it's looking for the few percent effect here. So where do we stand right now? As we all know, the post-Planck limits are something like this, that Planck alone gives us a limit of like one electrovolt or so on the neutrino mass. I mean, this CMB alone. And if one adds, you know, galaxy, I mean, smaller scale information, then one gets something like a few ten, some sub-electrovolt number, depending on the details. Now, how this fits in the overall picture, we have to add the following remark. The same argument, of course, apply to sterile neutrinos. I mean, if we had these low-mass sterile neutrinos of a few electron-volt mass, like is preferred by these reactor anomaly story, and so then these sterile neutrinos, if they were exciting in the early universe, would act like hot dark matter, like the ordinary neutrinos, and therefore get the same kind of limits. So if this neutrino were fully thermalized, no, it would be completely excluded. And so on a plot like this, one shows the mass of sterile neutrino versus the effective excitation of it, then there's some sort of exclusion range here. And so if one wants like a one electron volt mass, it should be, you know, its excitation should be suppressed strongly in the early universe. But I think everybody's aware of that story. So there's a clear tension between the sterile neutrinos and in the low mass regime in cosmology. So one has to do something about that. One can, of course, prevent this thermalization by strong asymmetries in the active flavors, or by additional interactions among the sterile flavors. But that's a lot of work and requires a significant modification beyond just postulating sterile neutrinos. So if sterile neutrinos exist in that range, it's not just sterile neutrinos, there's a whole package of other things that have to come with it for it to be viable cosmologically, and I think that's the main message. So where do we stand with these neutrino mass limits? So I take this plot from Steen-Hannestad. I like it very much because one always discusses, you know, what about data sets and a model assumption. So it's very clear what people usually do is one assumes a minimal CDM model, then if you use the CMB, you only get like a one electrovolt mass limit. If you add more data sets, you get a more and more restrictive limit. On the other hand, if you enlarge the model space in cosmology, adding other parameters that might vary, like the equation of state parameter W and other things, then of course the limit gets worse as you add more parameters. And so that is a very well-known situation that, you know, if you add more here, you get a worse limit. If you add here, you get a better limit. And this is shown in this way. If you move up that road, the whole thing may become a house of cards. And if you move that direction, it becomes rock solid, but kind of stupid. So there's a compromise here. Everybody knows that, but just be aware of that's the situation. The real point is not so much, I think, what is the number right now, because I mean, if the mass limit is 0.3 or 0.2 electron volts, doesn't change very much at this moment. What we want to know is we want to measure it. And so the question is, where is that all going? And that has been studied in this community planning study, as taken from that study here, where people forecast what could possibly be reached in future, including, you know, the next generation CMB experiment, maybe this fourth generation stage four type of experiments, 5-15 years from now, new galaxy service, Euclid, EBOS, DAISY, and whatever they're called. And the idea is that for sure, if all goes reasonably well, one will pin down the neutrino mass in cosmology. Of course, it would help to know the mass hierarchy from lab experiments, but we could maybe pin it down here, or pin down the normal hierarchy mass, if that's what we have. So I think this is clearly going in the direction of pinning down the neutrino mass in the sky. So I expect in my lifetime to see that measurement from cosmology coming forward. So in future, in another plot showing the same thing, it's sort of expect, if all these things develop as forecast, one would expect that one could actually pin down the neutrino mass within a reasonable range above zero, and really see evidence for neutrino mass in the sky, not just limits. And this NF parameter that Gary was talking about might be pinned down to, like, you know, 0.02 or so units, which, however, would not be good enough to distinguish 3 from 3.046, but it would be good enough to really rule in or rule out these large amounts of extra dark radiation. Okay, let me come to my conclusion. Yeah, perfect. So I think there's a number of astrocosmo limits we've discussed. So ordinary stars, globular clusters, give us the most restrictive limit on the neutrino dipole moment for all kinds of combinations of flavors. But it can be somewhat improved, but that's more or less where we are stuck. I don't think this will improve very much in future. Supernova physics. There are a number of non-standard limits or non-standard properties from supernova 87A, which I haven't talked about. But flavor oscillations would have a huge impact on supernova physics, but it's very difficult to pin this all down at the present time. We have no high statistics measurement yet. It'll be forthcoming, I'm sure. And of course, we need to know, are there still neutrinos, what is the mass hierarchy, and so on, to really make progress here. But supernova is, of course, a very important application, I would say, of any of these things. And of course, in cosmology, we have the most restrictive mass limits on neutrinos right now. I'm almost certain there will be a measurement in the future, not just a limit. Dark radiation will be pinned down, and which however has nothing to do with neutrinos probably. It's important, if there were dark radiation, it could not be active neutrinos because of the argument that Gary has proposed. I mean, because of flavor oscillations and of the BBN limits, if there's a significant amount of dark radiation, it would not be active neutrinos by all we understand about the early universe. And of course, there are very strong limits on the sterile neutrino modulo additional effects, which can make it possible after all. Thanks.
Thank you for this very nice talk. Christian for Gil.
This lepton asymmetry that you discussed, does it contribute to pulsar kicks?
In the supernova? Well, as I was saying, it doesn't seem to, because it's this funny feature. What's very asymmetric is the deleptonization flux, whereas the luminosity of the supernova seems to be within, on the percent level, symmetric. So it would certainly provide some kick on the tens of kilometer per second level, or even somewhat larger. I mean, the problem is nobody has yet done a simulation of that effect all the way through the cooling phase. We think that this asymmetric effect has to do with the accretion phase. So once the supernova explodes, we think this asymmetry will decay and it becomes symmetric again. So, but if that's really true or not remains to be seen, right? So,
just wait for the microphone.
I've read your paper very well, and if I remember correctly, the mass accretion onto the proton-neutron star is aspherical. It all occurs on one side, so you can get a pulsar kick. It's not from the neutrinos.
Oh, no, no, of course. No, but he was asking about the neutrinos. I mean, as Chris was explaining yesterday, I mean, most of the supernova models, like the hydrodynamical kicks, where the asymmetric explosion is what gives the recoil of a neutron star. But of course, neutrinos will add to that, but how much exactly is not really known at this moment.
I was a little bit confused about the order of these magnetic moments, because we had a talk by Bahar Balantekin a few weeks ago, and he was talking about the standard model predictions and everything. And my impression was that the standard model prediction was of the order of 10 to the minus 19 Bohr magnetons for Dirac and Majorana.
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
So
yeah.
It's a little bit different. But the limits were already at the order of 10 to the minus 15.
No. That may have been a theoretical self-consistency argument for Dirac neutrinos, but there's no such limit.
Wasn't that from effective operator arguments or something like that?
Yeah, there was a theory argument, but not an observational argument. Pardon me?
Well, we had a discussion a couple of weeks ago. The theory argument had several loopholes. There are symmetries which would allow for neutrino magnetic moment to be non-zero, while keeping the neutrino mass zero, the Voloshin SU2 symmetry. So I think, yeah, the comment that Water is making is that it's more of a theory argument, but it has several loopholes.
So back to the lepton asymmetry. So would you be able to post-dict the neutrino spectrum if from information from the remnant or a pulsar kick or something like that? I mean, would you, from observing the supernova, know?
At this moment, it didn't quite look like that, but I think this has not not really been investigated very much. I mean, this effect has just been discovered and not even been confirmed by other modelers. So, I mean, it remains to really understand what it will do for different issues as far as both explosion or neutrino oscillations are concerned and so on. I mean, it's just, you know, a very early discussion of this, yeah. I mean, we think the effect is real, but I should say that other workers do not share that opinion. There's a paper by, Adam Burrows and collaborators who have investigated a 2D model where they do not find this effect very explicitly. Now, these are 3D models in Garching, and it's very difficult to compare these different outcomes. I mean, another group has also found the same effect, another group has not found it. But there are very many differences in implementation. So you know, it remains to be better understood. But I mean, we are fairly convinced it's real and fairly dramatic, actually.
I got there first. Georg, there is a relatively recent paper that I believe claims a limit of something like 0.14 electron volt for the sum of the neutrino masses from astrophysics and cosmology.
I think it was a few days ago a paper including the Lyman alpha forest.
Do you have an opinion?
Well, I think it's the usual effect that if you include Lyman alpha forest, you probe the smallest scales, you get the strongest limit. But I have not enough of an opinion on the paper itself to confirm or critique it.
Okay.
And but I think it's the same old trend that we knew before, right? If you include Lyman alpha forest, you get the strongest limits. It's in this house of card game right on top, right?
And when you talk in this slide about non-standard gravitational interactions being limited, I presume you mean what's being limited is the absence of gravitational interactions.
Yes, I didn't make this point here. I mean, it is this usual argument that the Shapiro time delay of the supernova 87A neutrinos between photons and neutrinos shows that neutrinos interact in a standard way with gravity to 10 to minus 3 or so. And the point I also should make is, in future, in the next galactic supernova, when we also observe presumably gravitational waves, within milliseconds or 10 milliseconds of the bounce, you can do the same exercise between neutrinos and gravitational waves. So that'll be the only way of saying that gravitational waves gravitate. I think that's a nice thing to do with supernova neutrinos, but it's of course nothing. It's an answer to a question that you are not asking, right?
Since you mentioned magnetic moments and in the solar environment, what about the implications for supernova neutrinos? I mean, spin flavor precession in the magnetic fields of supernova.
Well, look, I mean, if the magnetic dipole moments were in this vague 10 to minus 12, 10 to minus 13 Bohr magneton range, you would again have a huge impact on the whole flavor conversion story. But again, it's such a complicated mess, basically, of B field configurations, meta configurations, turbulent or not, and so on and so on. So, I mean, it's very hard to come up with full predictions. This has been studied many years ago.
Many years ago, but not recently.
I'm not aware of recent studies of that stuff, no.
Any more questions? Yes.
Pascal.
Yeah, maybe you were a bit fast on the slide where you had the sterile neutrino mass versus the extra radiation, because in many of the data sets, I don't know if you could show it again, in many of the data sets...
This one?
No, the one on the mass on the y-axis. Yes, this one. So in many of the data sets, they include the bicep to anomaly, I guess.
This particular study included the bicep and the H0, and I think that's responsible for getting this sort of favored region where you might even think that a small extra contribution is actually favored by the data. I mean, I wouldn't take that too seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the main lesson from that figure is like that, right? That stuff below here is more allowed and up here is forbidden. So if you want an electron volt mass neutrino, as suggested by the reactor anomaly, it cannot be fully thermalized. I think that's the main lesson. The rest is fine points.
Yeah, no, but I mean, even without, if you don't want to explain SBL data, I would say without bicep, too, it's difficult probably, as also Gary was saying, to allow for one
sterile neutrino.
No, I mean, but biased or not, I mean, if a fully thermalized sterile neutrino, it cannot have a mass of 1 electron volt or larger. It's just too much. It's just the same old hot dark matter argument. And if you believe that the hot dark matter limits are in the sub-electron volt range, you know, you cannot make these things fit. It doesn't work. I mean, you have to invoke something new, which is okay, but the plain old simplest scenario of just invoking masses and mixings is not enough to make it work.
Yes. Don't you have this mixing angle on that graph, or doesn't the thermalization depend on how much it would mix with active?
No, of course. But in this graph, the authors just say, let's assume we have a certain fraction of stellar neutrinos, 1 or 0.1 or 0.3 extra flavors, no matter how it did in the universe, and then see what you get. Of course, if you want to go the road of predicting it, then you have to use, for example, this reactor implied points. The 3%, whatever it's called. So then you implement that, you get a perfect thermalization. You have to invoke a much, much smaller mixing angle to not thermalize it, or this extra physics. So, but this is a parametric study, which is, does not prejudice how you excite in the early universe. Yeah.
This is going back a bit, we all show these plots of the neutrino spectrum over some long range of energies, but missing always on these plots is the sum of the neutrino flux from all of these stars that are dominated by plasmon emission and so
on. It's in the
three white dwarfs and so on. I've never seen anybody do a calculation.
No, there are some
of the sum of all of those. Is there such a thing in the literature?
There is. Yeah, I can dig it up. I always thought somebody should redo this plot before it's shown, because the plot is incorrect now. People show the cosmic microwave, the cosmic neutrino background, which is of course not radiation; it's matter. So today, neutrinos have a mass. So. Maybe the lightest neutrino could
still... You make the most beautiful plots. Would you make that for us?
If you buy me a beer, I might do it.
German beer.
Two beers, okay.
Two beers.
So you said two beers.
Any more questions for Georg? If not, let's thank Georg again.